But first to magic, and in particular, the way in which the tales of the Arabian Nights brought significant change to our Western world. Described by my first guest, the marvellous Marina Warner, as a polyvocal anthology of world myths, fables and fairy tales, the stories of the Arabian Nights are a masterwork of Arabic literature with a flavour unmistakably their own. Many of the stories echo the Quran and the Bible, but their authors are unknown and their linguistic origins are many, coming from India, Persia, Greece, Turkey, Egypt. The tales of 1001 Nights were first translated into French in 1704 and pretty soon became a sensation with artists, intellectuals, composers across Britain as well. But according to Marina, it was the book's very strangeness, its hyperbole, its wild coincidence and a logical chain of cause and effect that greatly affect the imagination of readers. And by extension, for the first time, all sorts of things, such as human flight, seemed possible. Marina Warner, CBE, Professor in the Department of Literature, Film and Theatre Studies at the University of Essex. She was the Reith Lecturer in 1994, and her book is called Stranger Magic, Charmed States and the Arabian Nights. When I spoke to Marina in July, I asked her why she got involved in all this.
Well, I suppose there were two main catalysts. One was that I couldn't explain to myself why I so much loved this kind of literature, and people would slightly mock at me, you know, for, oh, I'm always going on about fairy tales. So I kind of wanted to look more deeply into the possible reasons for the appeal of enchantment, because I'm not a believer, I'm sympathetic sometimes to...
You're a good Catholic girl, Marina, sure.
Well, I'm like, you know, once a Catholic, but I don't profess a faith anymore. And I'm interested in Wicca and interested in Buddhism, but I don't espouse any of these things. But then, of course, I was very, very much charged up by the beginnings of the conflict in the Middle East. You know, I mean, I began reading around this subject in the 90s, and it got worse, and it went on, and there was the clash of civilizations, and there was a lot of propaganda swirling around, and I kind of wanted to see if literature, which I care about, and culture, could perhaps deliver a different picture, could give us, you know, some way of thinking about this civilization we were now apparently at loggerheads with. You know, we could enter the picture in a different way. And I think I found it. I think the Arabian Nights is
I think you've done it proud. And, of course, as you point out, your book begins with this perplexing passion, the paradox of a perplexing passion of the Enlightenment for a collection of medieval fairy stories.
Yes, especially from, you know, that are very tinged with Islamic cosmologies and jinn. And why on earth did the philosophers of the 18th century fall for this? Why did it become the sort of preferred way of storytelling for someone like Voltaire or Diderot? You know, what were they doing? And I think it was because this was emancipatory in a paradoxical way. This sort of extreme fantasy, these wonderful elaborations of absolutely improbable things, gave them a way of suggesting alternatives and utopian possibilities, and also critiquing very, very broadly the arrangements of their own time, the tyrannies and injustice. In the figure of the Sultan, you could see the figure of the absolute king.
Yeah, well, I want to have a talk about the Sultan shortly, but you're quite right in pointing out that the magic resonates in contemporary culture, in things like Mary Poppins and Peter Pan.
Yes, and that was an aspect that I was sort of fascinated by the flying in the nights. The book and the stories enact their own flights of imagination literally on the page. And then later, the flying carpet becomes a great favourite in films. And again, it's as if the film itself is a flying carpet that you get onto. And both Mary Poppins and Peter Pan centre the enchantment on flight. You remember the darling children,
yeah,
you know, learn to fly, and it's just, you just believe in it, and a little bit of fairy dust, and, you know, and the way to Neverland.
It is, in fact, a remarkably common dream, isn't it? The dream of flight. It recurs across all cultures.
Well, in psychoanalysis, they believe it's very much to do with sex, but it's also can go both ways. It can be a fear of falling as well as the fear of flying, as in Erica Jong's title, is a fear of falling, a fear of actually not achieving, you know, sexual passion, sexual fulfillment. But of course, it is an ecstatic, the lightness of being, the ecstatic, loss of the weightiness and worries of the world. And it's now central to so much filming. I mean, it's quite extraordinary. I remember first seeing it in Superman, I think, the special effects in which he zoomed around the universe. but now, you know, it's just, I think all children, I was told by a friend that he saw his little boy take a broomstick out of the cupboard downstairs and take it upstairs to his bedroom with him. And he asked him what he was doing. And he said, well, this is the way we get around now.
Yeah. Now, as we've already acknowledged, the popularity of the knights seems strange during the Enlightenment century. But the Victorians, as you point out, dismissed fairies and elves and pixies, et al., as belonging to a more primitive stratum of spiritual development. And yet, you reveal, and I didn't know this, that magic, or rather the knights, produced enthusiasm across all levels of society.
Yes, and we still have the very popular representations in pantomime at Christmas with Aladdin, and some of the higher levels have got into the kinds of magic realism books. You know, someone like Angela Carter's book Knights of the Circus is a homage to the knights in its structure, its storytelling, in the effervescent powers of the heroine. So, it continues to be extremely influential, but it offered a kind of disguise. When the Victorians felt uneasy and relegated fairies and elves to the nursery and made it a kind of children's literature, they had to expurgate the Arabian Nights really very severely, because the Arabian Nights are not written for children. They are full of extraordinary violence and cruelty, which of course does occur in children's fairy tales, but this at levels that are rather sophisticated about politics and sexual politics. But they're also very, 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 you know, wicked, naughty, erotic. So they had to be very, very controlled by if they were going to be suitable for children. But meanwhile, the Oriental mode gave adult writers a way of speaking about things that they couldn't speak about in propria persona as themselves.
The Earl of Shaftesbury was not amused, was he?
No, that's right. He said, yes, he identified it with women's stuff. That's another way that fairy tales used to be kind of scoffed at and despised. It was that they were not only for children, but they were also for old wives. They were just women's stuff. They were particularly sort of female servants were interested in this kind of romancing and this kind of nonsense. But but just to go back to the sort of serious way they were adopted, when someone like Diderot wanted to look at sexual politics in his time, he wrote a very famous fable called The Indiscreet Jewels, in which the wives of the Sultan, several wives, I think 40 of them, all speak about their experiences. Now, this is a very, this is the vagina monologues, if you like, in the 18th century. And at first it used to be considered pornographic and demeaning to women, because it's a comic ribald book. But now, feminist scholars, and the way I would read it, is that actually it's the young Diderot philosopher thinking about the oppression of women and actually articulating his resistance to it, his criticism of it, through the speaking jewels, which are the actual private parts of the Sultan's wives. And in all different ways, these 40 women describe the ways they are oppressed and the kinds of desires they have which they can't express or which they can only express clandestinely. So here the Oriental mode...
The erotic charge running through the stories is therefore unprincipled ingredient in their success.
Yes, and the erotic in some aspects, I mean, that was sort of taken up by the ways that someone like Richard Burton, one of its Victorian translators, responded to the book. But I think another more wider issue in terms of this emancipatory thrust of the stories relates to the idea of speaking itself, of telling stories itself, something we recognize very much in today's world, that it is important, you know, to free the voices of people in their countries at the level of censorship, but also at the level of private testimony. We have a huge commitment to that now as a culture. Well, an early place where you find that, and I think this is one of the reasons it did appeal to the rationalists and to the, you know, to the early readers of the book in the 18th century. One of the places you find that is in the frame story of the Knights, which is about a woman telling stories about injustice and tyranny and various forms of malfeasance to somebody who wants to cut off her head. And as she tells the stories to this man, she turns him around. He begins to see the world with more complexity. He begins to see wrongdoing. He begins to recognize the vicissitudes. And he realizes that just, you know, if you don't like somebody and you kill them, is not a civilized way of approaching a problem. So she, the whole of the book really is a, I mean, it's in deep disguise, but it's a moral lesson in measured response.
LNL on RN, and this chat first broadcast in July this year. I'm talking to Marina Warner about Stranger Magic, Charmed States and the Arabian Nights. The book is quite lusciously illustrated, and I commented to Marina that I wasn't aware there were so many visual evocations of the stories around.
No, it was for a long time a sort of deluxe illustrated book, and there are lots of amazing editions done by people like Edmond Dulac, wonderful Kai Nielsen from Scandinavia. Beautiful coloured illustrations in books. But there's also the Islamic and Arabic tradition itself, which people think, you know, on the whole doesn't have images and pictures, but that's not quite the case. I mean, there are very beautiful Persian miniatures with people in them. And actually, one of the places where I first became aware of this was in Sydney. There was an exhibition at the Gallery of New South Wales of a collection of Islamic art.
And there was a wonderful little exhibition, wasn't it?
Fabulous images. There's one reproduced in the book of the beauty of Joseph, the appearing in the harem of Zuleika, and the girls in the harem are so overcome by his beauty that they cut their hands with fruit knives. They're just completely, you know, smitten by, and this is an example of the acknowledgement in the book, in the stories in the book, of the power of desire, the power of love, and how in some ways this is not an excuse exactly, but a reason for so much human behavior. So they're quite, some of the stories in the Arabian Nights are really quite deep in their understanding of that, of those drives.
Marina, how do modern day Islamic countries view the Knights' tales?
It's has a very mixed reception. And I suppose that one of my, you know, motives was to show this range of Arabic and Islamic culture, because the fundamentalists and the Islamists are opposed to something like the Arabian Nights. It's far too colourful for them. they're very like the Puritans. I mean, they're very akin to evangelists, or, you know, in the sort of 17th century, or who would not condone this kind of literature. It's full of, not only is it full of love, sex, romance, desire, all kinds of relationships that are perhaps a little bit illicit. But of course, it's also full of drinking.
And it can be very bawdy. You mentioned Richard Burton, who also wrote tales based on the original translations, and he has a definite taste for breaches of decorum. There's that scene where the bridegroom farts on his wedding day and never recovers from the disgrace.
From the shame, yes. And when he returns to the town, they remember the day, and he overhears somebody saying, oh, yes, that was the day when so-and-so farted. So he realizes that even after 20 years of caste, nobody has forgotten this dreadful, dreadful. But, of course, you're completely right that that is an interpolated story by Richard Burton, not in the original, though there are stories of that kind. I mean, there are lots of low-life stories, there are lots of low criminality stories, and I've mostly gone for the enchantment. I've gone for stories of gin and magic and carpets and lamps. And
I take it that two of the famous stories that are attributed to the knights, Ali Baba and Aladdin, are also, in a sense, not kosher.
Yes, that the strict scholars of the actual transmission of the manuscripts relegate those stories to appendices in the translations, because there's no Arabic manuscript that's prior to the French translation yet discovered. So it looks as if Antoine Galland, who was the translator into French and the first publisher of the Arabian Nights, created some stories in the spirit of the knights, and these ones have been extraordinarily successful. I think partly because they show some of the structural, they show some structural parallels with fairy stories that were being written at the same time. I mean, the Aladdin story, if you think about it, is a sort of male Cinderella story. Rags to riches, he gets the princess. There are sort of scheming villains against him. There are no sisters or brothers, but you know, it has got that structure, and Ali Baba is a story of brilliant female cunning and on the part of Marjana, the slave girl who helps Ali Baba survive. But they've got a greater purchase because of that. The ones that I love and explored in more depth in my book are very complicated. They exhibit many of them are complicated. They exhibit the oral storytellers. Chains of memory, one story interpolated inside another story, set inside it, branching off into seven different episodes, each seven of the episodes branching off into three. This is very much the mnemonic system of the old traditional storytelling, because the storyteller has to remember.
And you can sense that rhythm, can't you,
in the way
they're presented.
Yes, with repetition and also lots of poetry. The poetry interrupts the story because it ekes out the night. The night, you know, you pass the time with these beautiful explosions of song and exchanges of, sometimes of, you know, there are there's invective is exchanged in poetic form between two characters.
We've mentioned that currently there's a very mixed feelings in Islamic countries towards the knight's tales, but as you point out, even way back when, they provoked quite angry responses from 10th century scholars who dismissed them as 1,000 trifles,
and yes,
it's almost as though they were seen as pulp fiction.
Well, I think it's on two levels. One is that the language that they're originally written down in is a colloquial vernacular Arabic. That's not the classical, the pure classical Arabic. And that, you know, displeased. There's a long tradition of a very pure, beautiful language that's really only now coming, opening up to other forms of Arabic, dialectical forms or local forms. You know, it's what's called diglossia. There are two forms of language. It's like Mandarin and the Chinese local languages. So there's Arabic, which is what the newspapers are printed in, so everyone can read them. And then there's the local Tunisian, which is different from Gulf Arabic. So in the Arabian Nights is written in a sort of Syrian local thing, and that was not admired. It was thought to be coarse, and apparently it's not a very beautiful form. It's not like reading Shakespeare.
Incidentally, raised Shakespeare, I had no idea that they influenced his writing.
Yes, and there's a lot of exchanges that must have come, you know, through the sailors and the pilgrims and the merchants, and just word of mouth. And, you know, we are the human species is a narrative species. It's one of our distinguishing characteristics. We love telling stories to one another. And, you know, they were such good stories, many of them, that they traveled. Yes, the Merchant of Venice, and Chaucer has some. Not the Merchant of Venice. Sorry, the Taming of the Shrew, and
as you point out, Park Prospero. There's quite a lot of hints in Shakespeare.
Yes, there was a lot of traffic with the Orient. I mean, there was a lot of the whole Venetian setting of several plays, Yes, The Merchant of Venice and Othello, for example, are very imbued with the kind of the frontiers of the Ottoman Empire. One sort of senses that presence there through the handkerchief in Othello is definitely a kind of Islamic talisman. He says when he gives it to her that it comes from Egypt and that it's imbued with the magic of, that will, and she mustn't lose it because it's a powerful love charm. And of course, when she does lose it, the disaster occurs.
Marina, how far back have you been able to trace the knights? How many centuries ago were they kindled?
Well, it seems that the first reference to and the idea of a woman telling stories to save her life was actually referred to in the 9th century in India. So that this frame story exists then. But the first manuscript of a whole set of stories is 14th century, and that's the earliest set of the stories we have. But really, I think that, I mean, the way I see it, more than as looking at it as a discrete, separate, distinctive book, I see it as a genre, and a genre that can be added to, which is why the Antoine Galland editions or the Burton editions are legitimate. They're not. It's not as if they're kind of imposters or plagiarists. The genre invites more elaboration, more invention. It gives permission to imaginations to take flight. That's one of its great, great resources.
You're listening to Late Night Live on RN and to a special week of repeat programs from earlier this year. In this one, I'm chatting to Marina Warner, author of Stranger Magic, Charmed States and The Arabian Nights. I interrupted you a long time ago when you were talking about the caliph who you started to talk about him, who enjoyed disguising himself in order to roam the streets of his capital, Baghdad, and eavesdrop on his subjects to discover their secrets. Now, he's similar to the owner of the secret Arcadian library, which you were privileged to have access to for the book. Tell us about that.
Yes, well, that was indeed a huge pleasure and a great privilege, because it's a private library, a secret library. If you look it up on the web, though, you can see its existence and its marvelous publications. It has a whole series of extremely beautiful, richly illustrated books that it doesn't actually give you an address. So it is like a figure in the Arabian Nights, and he's an anonymous philanthropist who's put this together. But it's not, you can go by invitation. So anyone who's got a sort of project that is really would legitimately benefit from the collections of the library, with an introduction, will be allowed to go. But that's fairly restricted in some ways. The library actually almost exactly matches what I was trying to do, because it's a library about Western. It's a library in Western languages. It doesn't specialize in Arabic languages, though it does have one manuscript of the Arabian Nights. What it specializes in is Western attitudes to Arabic culture. So it has lots of travel literature, lots of early publications of Arabic knowledge, of Arabic science in the West. So it shows, I mean, it really reveals how deep this intellectual, cultural, and emotional conversation ran before the current conflicts and hostilities. We were much closer and more involved, and we mutually benefited one another in ways that need to be more acknowledged.
I cannot resist reading a couple of paragraphs from your fine work. You're talking about one collection in the Arcadian Library in London. They are 30 octavo notebooks written in a variety of hands with a sprinkling of red letter headings. The boards have been softened by handling, the pages tattered and torn. These copies have been read to bits, as with paper money, after long use. A smell of human hands and breath rises from these working copies. They have the every look of a professional storyteller's precious resources. Love that.
It was an amazing, because they're in acid-free boxes, of course, because they're precious manuscripts, so they're in acid-free boxes. But when you open the boxes, I know that particular sort of creaturely aroma from traveling in the East. You know, I don't know if now it's the same these days, but, you know, 10 years ago, if you traveled in some of the countries of the Far East, the money had been used and used and used and used and used, and it had this creaturely aroma. And these manuscripts are like that, though they're on paper, they're not on leather. I thought they might be on skin, which is why they had that, but no. And you did, I did feel that this was a clue to how the Arabian Nights were disseminated. I mean, that someone had the book, they had a copy, a manuscript copy, and they would, you know, they would learn it, and then they would tell them. So that it would pass from the voice, it's describing an oral set of stories by Shahrazad in the original, and then it goes to the page, and then it becomes oral again. It's animated by the voice of the storyteller again, but it does exist as literature. So it's not oral. It's not the unwritten. It's the written that is performed.
Yeah.
A slightly different category of literature.
I keep seeing images of you flashing across the sky, the night skies on your flying carpet, and there you are looking down on Samuel Coleridge's Rime of the Ancient Mariner, published in 1817, and you see this as striking the same cold thrill as the nights.
Well, Coleridge had a copy when he was a child, and he says in his autobiography that he used to be frightened of approaching it. He wanted to approach it and read some more. And he would look at it on the windowsill in his chamber and wait for the sunlight to reach it. And then when it was warm, he'd put his hand out and take it. And he was so frightened by many of the stories. He specifies that the one that frightened him was The Merchant and the Genie, where the merchant is traveling and he's eating dates from a sort of little leather pouch he has, and he's chucking the date pits to the side of the road as he goes. And suddenly a vast genie appears, towers to the sky, bellowing with rage, and says that one of the date pits has killed one of his children. And Coleridge said that this opening of this particular cycle of stories in the nights just terrified him so much that his father took the book away and burned it. That's what Coleridge says, That's true or not. But actually, that takes me to what you know, that sort of moment, that marvelous narrative opening, reveals the importance of the djinn in the stories, because they can go both ways. You see, this djinnie threatens him with killing him on revenge of the loss of his child. But you see, they're both mortal, which means they have real human character, unlike the sort of devils of some fairy tales. And they're not only bad. They can be good too. They can bring benefits. And so they're sort of angelic and diabolical. They're intermediate beings. They're made of shimmering fire. And they are, above all, the most amazing narrative agents. They're brilliant characters producing, you know, prodigies and surprises. And, you know, they just have an extraordinary, brilliant energy when they appear in a story.
We're talking on the anniversary of the publication of Alice in Wonderland by Eerie Coincidence.
Yes.
Do you detect any influence in Lewis Carroll? One can see it, as you point out, in Salman Rushdie, for example, and, you know, and Borgia.
But yeah, absolutely. He doesn't tell us that he knows the knights, and it's not entirely clear that he has been directly influenced, but there are crossovers, I mean, that are, I think, very indicative of the general pervasive realms of imagination that the knights opened up and kind of confirmed for that generation of people. The whole concept of Wonderland, the whole concept of the invisible, which Lewis Carroll was really committed to. I mean, in his later books, Sylvie and Bruno, he actually talks about the levels of consciousness, and one of which is a state of suspended sort of reverie in which what is eerie and what is uncanny can be felt, can be experienced, and he calls that, this is the experience of fairyland.
It's interesting that, I'm sorry, I interrupted, keep going.
No, I just think that here we're beginning to get into the phase when people are no longer despising or turning away from the idea of enchantment, where they're beginning to see that enchantment has possibilities that are, you know, that are perfectly legitimate for adults to entertain, to because it can open your mind to different ways of thinking that are valuable. And what is interesting also about Carroll's later fiction, Sylvie and Bruno, and it's present a little bit in Alice, is that he's really a scientific rationalist. You know, there's all this wonderland, but at the same time, what he's saying is, how is the world made? What is the logic of the world? You know, he was a mathematician, and you can see he's a mathematician in many of his books. And that links very closely to the Knights, because one of the arguments that I've made is that there's a lot of intuition of the future in the Knights. There's a lot of the imagination and fantasy, the flying carpet, taking you to places that in the 14th century had absolutely not happened, but by the 20th century were definitely, you know, part of our ordinary world. I mean, the djinn are very like kind of mobile phones. The flying carpet is definitely, obviously, a vehicle of flight. And then there are things like, you know, as the crisis we're living through in capital and in money, many of the stories in the Knights are about money. The money is phantasmatic. The money disappears. The money suddenly appears. This is, you know, a lot of it has a very strong relation to current phenomena.
When the Knights were taken up so enthusiastically in the West, did that feed back to any extent to the East? In other words, was there some sort of cultural colonialism taking place?
It's a marvelous question, that, because it's a very, very complicated interchange that happens. For example, in Japan, the Arabian Nights appeared to the early Japanese reformers and modernizers as the epitome of Western sophistication. So when you wanted to be Western, you would be Orientalist. And apparently now, one tiny sort of anecdotal remains of this passion they had, the Japanese, is that the best thing to have in your wedding photograph is a camel. So you dress in white, which is Western.
Right?
Western influence, you dress in white. So as we know, the Oriental wedding is a white Western wedding now. That's what it looks like. But the photographer's studios have scenes behind them in which there's a camel, absolutely unknown animal in Japan. I read this in a book which is about Japanese Orientalism, the way the Japanese kind of refracted a different kind of Orientalism through Western Orientalism back into their own. So, you know, the as it were, it's a kind of Madame Butterfly effect it's a double mirror.
Well, I remember at that exhibition at the Art Gallery of New South Wales you talked about, one could see the ebb and flow of influence, you know, particularly along the trade routes.
Absolutely. The Silk Route and other trade routes, and across the Mediterranean, a tremendous amount of crisscrossing. I mustn't be too Pollyannish about it. I mean, one of the interests, historical interests of reading the Knights is that you see the tensions that did actually, put in opposition one, you know, the Christians. Within the Knights, there's a lot of prejudice against Africans, and I've criticized that in the book. It's the endemic problem of racism is visible in the stories of the Knights against sub-Saharan peoples, and that I also argue that that's one of the disguises that actually made it possible for them to be popular. This is a very negative reason for them to have become popular. But if you think about the way the wicked enchanter in Aladdin is booed. And he's always, you know, that he's always portrayed as a kind of foreigner, as an outsider.
Yeah.
That picks up from the book. The foreigners and the outsiders are, you know, often harshly treated, and I think that it offered a kind of an excuse. You know, it's a little bit like rendition. We get them to do it, yeah, and then we can do it. But really, it's them that's doing it. So it's not really us doing it.
The voice of Marina Warner, CBE, a professor in the Department of Literature, Film and Theatre Studies at the University of Essex. Her book, Stranger Magic, Charmed States and the Arabian Nights, published by Random House. You're listening to a special week of LNL on RN, where we're revisiting some of our programs from earlier this year. Coming up, Venetian navigators.